Okay, let's unpack this. For today's deep dive, you've handed us, well, a truly fascinating account.
Fascinating, yes, but also deeply unsettling, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. It takes this cornerstone of American comfort, you know, an icon everyone recognizes.
Pearl sand.
Right. Synonymous with warmth, that secret recipe. And it just twists it into something far more disturbing than you'd probably ever imagine.
It's like considering that food you trust something familiar.
Yeah, exactly. And then thinking, what if its earliest origins, based on the specific story we're looking at today?
This single potent account.
What if those origins are steeped in a history that's just so dark, so ambiguous, it just shifts your whole perception?
And that's the mission today, isn't it? To really dig into this one narrative.
We're talking about maybe unearthing a hidden, almost unspeakable truth behind this figure. This is the real Harlan David Sander, according to this account, anyway.
Long before the brand.
And his early life, as the story tells it, it just has these whispers, these dark whispers. The legend is the recipe, right?
11 herbs and spices.
But what if the real ingredients, or maybe the foundation that legend was built on, what if it was something far more sinister?
And that stark contrast is what's so gripping here. How a seemingly simple narrative, almost like a dark folklore,
Yeah, it feels like that.
how it can hold such profound, unsettling ambiguities. So our job today is to meticulously examine this source, the seven spices no one opened.
That title alone is something.
It is. We're peeling back the layers, of time and legend, not really digging into culinary history in the usual
No, this
sense.
isn't about fry times or anything.
No, it's about confronting the chilling story hidden inside this account. It's not about proving historical fact, per se.
Right, we're looking at the source itself.
Exactly. It's about pulling out every unsettling nugget from this story, understanding what it claims happened, but also the why it matters.
The implications.
Yeah, the implications for how we remember things, the stories we tell ourselves, it reads less like history and more like,
Like a whispered secret.
or a forgotten ledger entry, maybe? Something found in an old box. It's dense with these suggestive details, contradictions, so many unanswered questions.
And our goal is just to bring those out into the light for you, let you grapple with what this story
Because
suggests.
it definitely doesn't fit into a neat little box.
Not at all. Okay, so let's start. We're going back in time, not to a boardroom, but to 1912, Corbin, Kentucky.
A very specific place and time.
And again, this isn't the friendly face on the chicken bucket we're talking about yet. This is Harlan David Sanders, way before the white suit became iconic.
Before the recipe was famous.
Picture Corbin in 1912. It wasn't some quiet little town, it was a railroad hub.
Bustling. You'd have the constant noise, the steam, the trains.
Clanging metal, people shouting, a transient place, people always coming and going, right? On those trains.
Which meant anonymity. That's key here.
Yeah, easy to blend in, easy to maybe go unnoticed. People arrive, people leave, identities kind of blur.
It's the perfect backdrop, in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you wanted to operate quietly.
A constant stream of potential guests for a boarding house. And maybe, well, the story suggests maybe more than just guests.
A constant flow of people who might not be missed.
It provides this weird kind of isolation right out in the open where people could just vanish.
And that setting, that relentless, impersonal churn of the railroad town, it's so crucial for understanding the man this source describes.
So, what do people remember about him? The source points to two things.
Two primary, almost haunting details. The first one is his spotless white suit.
Which sounds odd, right? For 1912, Corbin.
Think about it. A grimy, soot-covered railroad town, coal smoke everywhere. And this guy maintains a spotless white suit.
It suggests something meticulous, obsessive, maybe.
Absolutely. It's almost unsettlingly fastidious, a stark contrast to everything around him. It's like a performance of cleanliness.
A mask of order.
Perhaps. It makes you wonder about the man underneath, why that level of care about appearance, especially when it seems so impractical.
And the second detail is even more chilling, I think.
The way he stared when you ate.
Just stared.
Yeah. So this raises a big question. What kind of person wears this immaculate suit in this dirty town and then fixates on his guests while they're eating?
Eating is vulnerable, isn't it? You're focused, maybe your guard is down.
Exactly. It's not just watching, it suggests something more. Predatory, a disturbing level of interest, especially when guests are exposed, relaxed.
It's the kind of stare that would make the food catch in your throat.
Definitely not your typical friendly boarding house host.
No. So you have this figure, this pristine white shape moving through a dusty world, and this intense, invasive stare. It just creates this immediate sense of unease.
Foreboding, even before anything specific happens in the story.
These aren't just quirks. According to this account, they're the first brushstrokes of a really disturbing picture.
Imagine being that weary traveler. You sit down for a meal.
And you just feel those eyes on you, that constant scrutiny.
It's not a memory you'd enjoy. It's one that would stick with you.
Or maybe, for some. It ensured they never left at all. The air around him must have felt charged somehow.
That subtle horror that just gnaws at you, makes you doubt things.
And inevitably, in a boarding house story, it comes down to the food.
The food is central.
So the source introduces this thing called the house special. And right away, what's weird is...
It was never on the menu?
Right. Not openly offered. It was exclusive. Secretive, almost. Like you had to be chosen for it.
It implies this hidden layer... Something outside the normal rules of hospitality.
And the description of the dish itself, this is where it really sets off alarm bells.
Deep, primal disquiet, as you said.
It came in thick slices, pale and tender. Okay, thick slices. Suggests a big cut of meat, right?
Not chicken, not small game. Something substantial. What provides that kind of volume?
And then pale and tender. Well, lots of meat can be pale and tender, but in this context.
Coupled with the secrecy, the staring host... It becomes sinister.
Yeah.
Unidentifiable. Doesn't fit neatly.
Almost unnervingly. Familiar, maybe. But you can't quite place it.
And then the faint sweetness. That's the detail that really lingers, isn't it?
A sweet taste in meat. Unless it's like glazed ham or something. It's just wrong.
What causes that? Is it natural to whatever this was? Or is it masking something?
That's the chilling thought. Was the sweetness deliberate? To hide a taste that was... Maybe repulsive?
Or make the unpalatable palatable, like a deliberate transformation.
And it clung to your clothes for days. Not just a taste, an odor that you couldn't wash off.
Like an imprint, suggesting the very essence of it was somehow indelible, a mark.
And the source is explicit. No poultry, no beef, nothing from the market.
That's the clincher. No identifiable origin, no legal source. It bypasses everything known.
It enters the realm of the... Well, the terrifyingly unknown.
And the implications of that, back in 1912, they're huge. Think about the era.
No real food safety laws to speak of, not like today.
Exactly. Very few inspections, limited protections. People trusted their boarding house hosts implicitly.
So a host providing meat not from the market, that immediately sends up massive red flags. It's a total bypass of any accountability.
And that faint sweetness... It just defies normal cooking. You mentioned decomposition, or maybe unconventional preservation.
Or just the inherent property of something. Unusual.
It really sounds like a mask, doesn't it? Or a byproduct of some strange preparation needed to make it edible.
It suggests this dark ingenuity, making the abnormal seem normal through taste and smell.
What kind of meat needs that kind of lingering disguise? It forces you to question what sustenance even is.
And people ate it. Because right after describing this deeply weird house special...
The narrative takes that truly alarming turn. From unsettling details to, well, people disappearing.
The source just states it. Quietly. Chillingly. Travelers, the one who stayed just one night, sometimes never reach their next stop.
It's not subtle. It draws a direct, terrifying line.
The secret dish, the staring host, and then... People just vanishing.
It paints this horrifying picture. Someone alone, passing through, checks in, eats the special meal.
And then they're just gone. Sometimes never reach their next stop. That implies it wasn't just once.
A chilling regularity. A pattern. Almost like the house where the dish itself just absorbed them.
Leaving no trace. You can picture the train leaving Corbin. An empty seat, a ticket not used.
And who's looking? In that transient blur, their absence is easily missed. Swallowed by the anonymity.
Which brings us back to the vulnerability of travelers back then.
Absolutely. The anonymity of rail travel was a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom, yes, but huge risks.
People were just expected to move on. No instant communication, no missing persons databases.
How many no-shows were there before anyone even noticed? If they ever did, who would be looking? Family far away, an employer who assumes they just quit.
The lack of ties in that environment meant people could just... evaporate.
And that silence, the lack of follow-up, the lack of an alarm system, it's as unsettling as the disappearances. A void where accountability just didn't exist.
Allowing these patterns to maybe go on for who knows how long, undetected.
It's terrifying to be that alone, that untraceable.
So this pattern of disappearances, the weird meat, the host, It all comes to a head, according to the source, on one specific night.
A turning point. From implied horror to something concrete, visceral.
One winter night, a railroad porter told police he saw Sanders leaving the kitchen with a burlap sack. This is it. The first external witness.
Finally, someone saw something. Broke the pattern.
And the description of that sack, horrifyingly precise. It dripped dark onto fresh snow.
Wow. Picture that. Pure white snow. And this dark, thick liquid dripping from a burlap sack.
Instantly transforms the mundane into the horrific. It's undeniable. Something messy, something covert was happening.
Right out in the open for a moment. It's not rumor anymore. It's an eyewitness account. Tangible evidence.
The thread that could finally unravel the whole thing.
Which raises the question, why that night? Was Sanders getting careless? Bolder?
Or was it just the starkness? The duck on the white snow? Impossible to ignore.
That contrast probably made it stand out. Made someone finally speak up. The quarter's testimony is the key. It connects the dots.
Turns the vague fear into something specific, actionable for the police.
It's the moment the horror becomes visible, demanding attention, forcing a confrontation.
And what happens next when the police finally search? It's just as revealing. They go straight for the smokehouse.
Which makes sense, given the context.
But what they don't find tells the story. The smokehouse was scrubbed bare, no meat, no ash.
Scrubbed bare, that's not panic, that's calculation. Meticulous effort.
Suggests someone who knows how to conceal things, how to eliminate evidence thoroughly.
The absence of meat is one thing, but no ash. Ash implies burning, disposal. Even that was gone.
How was it all processed? How was it disposed of so completely? It hints at premeditation. Practice, maybe.
Like this wasn't the first time a cleanup was needed.
Yeah.
A methodical approach to whatever dark work was happening there.
Chillingly organized. Yeah. And against that backdrop of eerie emptiness.
There's the one thing they do find. The incongruous detail.
Just a neat row of 7 metal tins, lids rusted shut.
Neat row. Again, order amidst the implied chaos. 7 tins. Like an inventory, a collection.
And rusted shut means they'd been there a while, right? Holding secrets long before the porter saw anything.
This wasn't hasty. It was deliberate containment. Part of a system, a dark process. Those tins were storage.
And the number 7, you have to wonder, why 7?
It feels significant somehow, doesn't it? Though the source doesn't explain why.
But the power of that system, or just the horror inside those tins, it becomes terrifyingly clear.
When the deputies try to investigate them.
The source says, the smell inside them was enough to keep the deputies from opening a second time.
Stops you cold, doesn't it? Not just a bad smell. An odor so potent, so overwhelmingly wrong.
That it stopped law enforcement. Men who've probably seen and smelled terrible things.
They opened one tin, got one whiff, and couldn't face another. What causes a smell like that?
Something so viscerally repulsive it halts an investigation. Makes trained officers retreat from the truth.
It's the horror of the unseen, that sheer revulsion becoming a physical barrier. The air itself becomes terrifying.
And we have to remember the context, forensics back then.
Exactly, 1912. No DNA tests, no sophisticated labs. Their senses were primary tools.
So for a smell to be that bad, so fundamentally abhorrent, it physically stops them.
It speaks volumes about its unimaginable nature. It bypassed reason, went straight to primal disgust.
Suggesting they knew somehow or believed whatever was inside was beyond comprehension.
So fundamentally inhuman, maybe, that the smell alone was confirmation enough. Further examination felt psychologically impossible.
What did they think was in there that was worse than that smell?
It's a terrifying question. The smell itself became the ultimate deterrent, a horror that repelled investigation.
So after all that, the witness, the scrub smokehouse, the 7 tins, that smell, you'd expect consequences, right?
An arrest seems inevitable. A trial, something.
But the narrative is chillingly abrupt. A week later, Sanders left town.
Just back that. Gone.
No arrest, no manhunt, no charges. He just vanished back into that anonymity the railroads provided.
Slips away. It says a lot about law enforcement limits then, or maybe just his ability to disappear.
Maybe without proof of what was in the tins, the horrifying smell wasn't enough.
Plausible. Without definitive forensic evidence, maybe the case just stalled, and he took his chance.
Leaving behind the stench, the questions, the dread, the train pulls out, he's gone.
And what's truly fascinating, almost mind-boggling, is the transformation later.
The sheer audacity of it.
This man, linked in this account to disappearances,
yeah.
Weird meat, unspeakable smells, just vanishes.
And then decades later.
Reemerges, reinvented, cleansed somehow.
Yeah.
Becomes an icon of wholesome Americana.
It speaks to the power of time, image, branding to just erase history, doesn't it?
Or obscure it, at least. Collective memory is flexible. People prefer the comforting story.
It's like societal amnesia.
Oh.
Allowing this figure with this alleged past, according to the source, to become synonymous with family meals.
A new narrative gets superimposed, scrubbing away the stains with the shine of success. The transformation is almost as unsettling.
Which is where the story takes its most jarring leap, bridging that huge time gap.
From early 1900s Kentucky to mid-century America.
Decades later, a smiling old man in a white suit sold fried chicken across America.
The contrast is dizzying. From that guy in Corbin.
Staring. The secret meat, the disappearances.
To the benevolent face of fast food. The white suit is still there, but now it means clean, trustworthy.
The stare is gone, replaced by the smile. The secret, unsettling special is replaced by the famous public recipe.
It's branding as alchemy, turning potential horror into comfort, a household name.
But then comes the final twist in the source material, the link that ties it all together.
And this might be the most chilling part, the advertising slogan.
11 herbs and spices. Everyone knows that.
But this account says, wait a minute, 7 of them have no name and no origin anyone can trace.
7. That number again.
We have to pause there. Remember the smokehouse?
A neat row of 7 metal tins, rusted shut, filled with that unbearable smell, which the police never opened.
And now, 7 spices, with no name and no origin anyone can trace.
Is that just a coincidence? A random number?
Or is it something deliberate? A twisted little wink? A dark signature from a past that wouldn't stay buried?
An echo embedded right in the recipe itself?
The idea of an untraceable origin for those specific 7, it's profoundly weird. It suggests a secret that can't be explained away.
A lineage that can't be acknowledged, linking the past horror to the present icon.
It's like a whisper from that smokehouse, hidden in plain sight. A haunting numerical signature.
So what does this all mean? For the legend, the icon, the comfort food we thought we knew?
It means the story, at least according to this account, is way more complex, more unsettling, more ambiguous than any ad campaign shows.
It challenges you, doesn't it, to look past the smiling face, the white suit.
And consider the shadows that might lie beneath.
So we've journeyed through this story. The spotless suit hiding secrets, the special meal linked to vanishings.
The unbearable smell from 7 tins halting an investigation in a Kentucky town.
It's a really stark reminder, isn't it, that even the most familiar symbols, the most comforting icons, might have roots, according to this narrative, that are truly disturbing, unvarnished.
The ambiguity is everywhere, but the creepiness is undeniable. It makes you question the stories you've accepted.
Makes you wonder how much we really know.
And that raises the broader question, doesn't it? In our world, full of carefully crafted images and brands.
How many other origins are veiled like this, waiting for someone to dig deeper into the why?
This story shows how history, memory, even branding can sanitize things, obscure uncomfortable truths.
Highlighting what works now, burying what came before.
Society chooses what to remember, what to forget, or maybe just what to reshape into something easier to swallow.
The story of Harlan David Sanders, as told in the 7 spices no one opened, it's just a chilling reminder that some secrets maybe don't get erased.
They just get repackaged.
Perhaps the real secret isn't in the spices themselves, but in what they were designed to obscure, and the chilling thought that some tastes, once acquired, are never truly forgotten.